understood that on a basic level, people just needed higher wages and more money, basically. And to make this into a moral or personal vendetta against the poor was an obscenity. And she dedicated much of her life to creating media around that. And in our work in the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, to bringing at this point probably thousands of people, including working poor people, back into the fold, teaching her methods.
Could you talk about some of the big stories that have come out of the project since Barbara founded it?
Yeah, I mean, I can also talk about some of the ones she was most proud of, because they're now at the front of my mind as I'm sort of mourning. One of them was a writer, Darrell Wellington, who sold his own plasma. And so he wrote about that experience of selling his own plasma and then widening out the plasma industry. There's a writer who herself is financially insecure, who wrote about taking in an unhoused couple as part of a social program, kind of an NGO program, and what that meant, and her own phobias and her own experience of that. So I feel like these are some of the stories that I'm most proud of, because they have the ring of truth and the intensity of human experience, coupled with an understanding, like, how do we destigmatize unhoused people? Oh, maybe we need to spend some time with them. And also, both of those stories had a sort of dark humor that was her signature.
Her last book, in fact, was about dying, wasn't it, Alyssa? We have about 10 seconds.
Yeah, it was about dying. And I think the profound takeaway for me from that was that each of our deaths is part of a broader social struggle. And the saga will continue after we go.
That book was called Natural Causes, and of course the one she is most famous for, Nickel and Dimed. Alyssa Court, friend and colleague of Barbara Ehrenreich, again, our condolences, and as well to Ben Ehrenreich, her son, and to Rosa Brooks, her daughter, and to so many others who cherished her whole family. Alyssa Court, Executive Director of Economic Hardship Reporting Project. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland.
This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I am your host, Paul Rowland, be with you for the hour. And I will be talking about the relevance of that song by Lou Reed with my guest, Bruce Levine, the anti-authoritarian psychologist and author, when I bring him into the conversation in just a couple minutes. I did want to mention, since Amy Goodman was talking about Barbara Ehrenreich, that... And we miss her very much. I've read some of her books, and she's been important in the progressive community for so long. And we've had her on this radio station quite a few times. at least half a dozen, I think quite a few more, going all the way back at least to 1997. Yeah, as I said, I had her on in 2018. I know she was on Joe Uris's show. And that's what KBOO Radio and Community Radio are all about, is bringing voices like Barbara Ehrenreich, who you're not generally going to hear on too many other outlets. Maybe occasionally on NPR, but this is one place. Especially, we have several programs devoted to authors, to books on this program. And on our talk radio, on our talk shows like this one, often have authors like the one I'm going to bring up in a second. So yeah, we're apparently not going to have our fall membership drive this year. A little break from that. But that doesn't mean that KBOO doesn't still need your support to keep functioning, to keep programs like this going out over the air. So please, if you value the programming like this show, like interviews with Barbara Ehrenreich and all the other great stuff we have on, go to kboo.fm and click on that donate button. Give us what you can. And one quick announcement. This Saturday, September 10, at Mother Foucault's bookshop at 523 Southeast Morrison, is going to be Old Dog, A Traveler's Tale by Mark Seeley. Just give you a quick, here's a blurb. Seeley challenges the culturally approved story that civilization is an inexorable march of progress, suggesting that in our quest to dominate the world, we have degraded and dehumanized ourselves and lost the ability to live authentically in the moment. In our attempt to enslave the planet, we have ended up enslaving ourselves to the infernal machine that we have created. So that's partly what this book is all about. Actually, that was a blurb about civilization heresies. He is actually going to be talking about Old Dog, A Traveler's Tale, which is kind of looked at through the mind and eyes of an old dog, looking at our human foibles. So yeah, that's the Mark Seeley this Saturday, September 10th at Mother Foucault's bookshop at 7 p.m., 523 Southeast Morrison. And with that, I welcome Bruce Levine back to our studios once again. Good morning, Bruce. Do we have Bruce? Oh no, looks like we're having some difficulties. Hopefully not as bad as last week, where I couldn't even hear out of my headphones. Well, okay, while we wait to hear Bruce Levine, I will introduce him properly. Bruce, this book is called A Profession Without Reason: The Crisis of Contemporary Psychiatry Untangled and Solved by Spinoza, Freethinking, and Radical Enlightenment. This is a little blurb from the publisher. There is a crisis in psychiatry today. Even the former director of the National Institute of Mental Health has said, whatever we've been doing for five decades, it ain't working. According to today's guest, Bruce Levine, the field of psychiatry requires a completely fresh look. And Levine finds that that needed perspective in the 17th century works of Baruch Spinoza. Readers unfamiliar with Spinoza will be intrigued by his life and the modern relevance of his radical philosophical, psychological, and political ideas. With the help of Spinoza, Free Thinking and Radical Enlightenment, A Profession Without Reason untangles and solves the crisis of contemporary psychiatry. So Bruce is a practicing clinical psychologist and author of a number of books, including Resisting Illegitimate Authority, which we talked about on this show 3 years ago. He's a regular contributor to Counterpunch, and his articles have appeared in the New York Times, Salon, Skeptic, and numerous other publications. And his website is brucelevine.net. That's, of course, L-E-V-I-N-E.net. And I guess we're still waiting to see if we can get Bruce back on the phone. I thought he was with us. But this is I've really enjoyed having Bruce on over the years. I've had him on three or four times. First, I think with his book, Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populace, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite. He clearly doesn't he doesn't limit his critique just to his own field, that of psychiatry and psychology, and but he kind of takes it to a broader view of the origins of why we get ourselves into such difficulties, which is something that I used to talk about a lot on this first Wednesday of the month program, when I had some co-hosts and often had guests from the Rethinking Psychiatry group who used to have their public events on the first Wednesday of the month. Not actually even sure if they've got those events going or not, but maybe if someone from that group is listening could call us up and tell us about it. And we're still waiting to get Bruce Aline back on the air. Gosh, it's always something, I tell you. Anyway, so, well, maybe I'll just start reading a little bit from the book. How about that? Give you a little taste of what Bruce has to say. The guiding force of this book is the spirit of Baruch de Spinoza, 1632 to 1677, who was banished from his community and risked death for the causes of free thinking and tolerance. Spinoza was a philosopher who used reason to understand everything. He was also a psychologist who provided antidotes to emotional suffering. His self-help ideas, along with his courageous life, were what first interested me, but Spinoza offers far more. He was also a radical political thinker who championed democracy. He recognized the damage to individuals and society caused by authoritarianism, and he rejected unquestioning obedience to both monarchs and religious authorities. A handful of mental health professionals are aware of Spinoza's wisdom about how our emotions can tyrannize us. But it would be a rare psychiatrist or psychologist who was aware of Spinoza's radical critique of theological dogma and his embrace of scientific rationality, and the relevance of this to modern ideas about mental illness. In Spinoza's theological political treatise, 1670, he put his life on the line, disputing the sacredness of the Bible. He did not challenge the Bible's... Are you with us, Bruce? Oh, gosh. I just don't know what's going on. But we do the best we can here, and we're going to get my guest, Bruce Aline, by hook or by crook before this hour is out. And so I've got his line turned up so he can just jump in at any time as I continue to read from the introduction to A Profession Without Reason. He did not challenge the Bible's divinity to mock religion. Rather, he did so because he knew that a divine Bible, the belief that it was the word of God, provided authorities with the power to coerce obedience, suppress free thinking, and institutionalize in... Hello, good morning, Bruce. Are you with us?
I can hear you.
Oh, there we go.
I've heard you all of this time. I've been in, like, I can producer can hear me, but something must be wrong there with your headphones or something.
No, not the headphones this time. That was last week.
Anyways, I've been listening to you.
Okay. Anyway, well, so we've got you now, and I already gave the listeners a taste of your writing. Read most of the first page of your book. You heard that, of course. But let's go back to the opening song, which you yourself requested, which was nice. You actually remembered that I have that habit of having a song start. So Lou Reed is a... You know, I actually just read just a few months ago a biography of Lou Reed and found out a lot about him that I didn't know, including that he had had electroshock and that he basically held that against his dad and, well, his parents in general, especially his dad, for pretty much his whole life, which is unfortunately, I think, something that happens when parents feel this to do such things to their children. And anyway, doesn't usually have good results. So talk about that song and Lou Reed. And, you know, he was really a beacon, a real important figure for a lot of disaffected, alienated youth, probably until this day.
And I think part of the reason that he had some of the same experiences early on, before it was common for this whole troubled teen industry and for 6-year-olds to be drugged on, you know, Adderall because they're not paying attention in school. I mean, he, back in the late 50s, he was just a moody guy. I mean, he's a Lou Reed, and he's 17 years old. His parents are just your sort of average, your kind of normie, whatever you want to call it, mainstream parents. They didn't know what the heck to do with him, and they took him to a psychiatrist. Next thing you know, this is, we're talking about the late 1950s, 1959. He's in New York, and they take him over to Creedmoor State Psychiatric Hospital in Queens, which is interesting for me because when I grew up in that New York area, I went to my college days were in New York before I moved to Cincinnati, and I had actually was a trainee for a while in that Creedmoor State Psychiatric Hospital, but I didn't know until much later that Lou came in there in the late many years before me, and when he was a patient, and he got, you know, 24 electroshock treatments, they call it ECT treatments, electroconvulsive therapy treatment, and he was real angry about that. I mean, in biographies, I don't know, there's a lot of biographies about him. I don't know which one you read, but the one of the ones that I talked about in an article that I wrote about him a couple of years ago by a guy named Levy, he said this was a major experience for him that radicalized him to completely distrust authorities. It was, and I see that happen with a lot of less famous people out there, that's a monumental experience as a young person, that you're just confused, you're not paying attention in school, you're really feeling like alienated or disconnected, a lot of like normal things that go on for any kind of sensitive, thinking, critically thinking person, and next thing you know, you're being coerced into taking these massive treatments. And in Lou's case, his sister talked about later that it really, she had memories, she was traumatized by it. Not only was Lou traumatized by it, but her sister was traumatized, but she remembers seeing him coming home, being in a, she uses phrases, unable to walk, stupor-like, and it just damaged his short-term memory horribly throughout his life. And one of the things that you hear in the mainstream corporate media is just all these so-called testimonies, I mean, not so-called, testimonies for electroshock, which still goes on nowadays. So you have these famous electroshock advocates that are talking about it out there, but you don't, they conveniently forget people like Lou Reed and Hemingway, who had horrible experiences. It didn't help them at all. In Hemingway's case, it was really a disaster. It led directly to his suicide. In Lou Reed's case, I mean, I guess you could call it a mixed bag, because it really fueled his anti-authoritarianism and his art in a lot of ways. So at least he got something out of it at the cost of his short-term memory.
Indeed. Yeah, well, you know, I know that suffering is known to fuel artistic creativity, but that might be a little extreme.
I think Lou would agree.
So, yeah, I've had guests on, a number of guests on, talking about ECT and the continued struggle against it. And I mentioned Rethinking Psychiatry earlier. They've had some panels, some of their events dedicated to that. And there's still a lively debate within the general umbrella of support for people with so-called mental illnesses, critiques of the way that so-called mental illness is dealt with in the society, et cetera, and that kind of those debates are talked about a lot in your book in various ways. And this is something, maybe just kind of go back. You mentioned Creedmoor. I know you actually talked about your experience. Maybe just sort of talk about that as sort of an introduction to you and how you sort of developed your point of view and got into the, you know, the profession that you work in.
Well, I think a lot of folks, when they first go into the mental health profession, and I was one of these folks. I didn't go in to be this kind of radical critic of psychiatry. I had some doubts about a lot of their ideas and their diagnoses early on. about things that I was familiar with, things like when they were calling stubborn kids with oppositional defiant disorder, or they were calling kids who just didn't pay attention in school ADHD, because I knew a lot of these folks personally, and I'd read about a lot of famous people like that who weren't diseased at all. There were good reasons why they were oppositional or noncompliant behaviorally or cognitively. But I think what happens to a lot of other folks is that anything that they're not really familiar with, so when you go into a psychiatric hospital, when you're first an intern or you're first a trainee as a mental health professional, and you see folks who are really acting really bizarrely, or at least, you know, something, behaving in ways that you've never experienced, or you don't have any, and never had any friends who acted like that, and they're behaving, you know, they're acting, they're talking incoherently, or they're saying things that make no sense at all, and it's frightening. And I think one of the things that naturally happens to a lot of people is that when they're frightened, or they're seeing something incredibly unfamiliar, or people are behaving in ways that make them very inconvenient, is for us to kind of leap into sort of controlling kinds of things, to lose our rational thought, to lose our wisdom, and to therefore start to fix labels that may be completely invalid, and to move into controlling processes. And so part of, like, I think one of the really valuable things about using a guy like Spinoza for a lens of taking a look at psychiatry is that this guy was very much aware of the impact that fear had, of the unfamiliar, and how that really distorted our quest to really get to the truth of things, what he called adequate ideas. It's a sort of close to a synonym of what we would call today validity. And so that was one of the many reasons why I thought Spinoza would be a good kind of lens, a good foil to take a look at contemporary psychiatry.
Mm-hmm. So were you already into Spinoza? Had you, like, studied him in college or something?
Yeah, I mean, he's one of those kind of guys. I think, you know, it's a real interesting, there's a real gigantic Spinoza fan club, Spinoza Admiration Society, and I had come across him as a teenager, and certainly I came across him like a lot of folks do when they take philosophy in college, and he's real hard to read directly. And so early on, what was fascinating for me, what was very accessible to me, was, number one, his life. I mean, I thought it was really interesting that this guy at 23 years old got himself banished, ostracized from the whole Portuguese Jewish community for what they labeled back then were monstrous deeds and abominable heresies, and he refused to, quote, mend his wicked ways. I think this was really interesting for me as a teenager in my early 20s. It was like, what the heck did he do to get that happen to him? And then the other thing that really interested me about him, without knowing really his philosophy, was why was that so many great famous thinkers really were enamored by him, probably one of the most famous ones being Albert Einstein, who said things, you know, who actually wrote a poem about Spinoza, saying, like, how much he loved this noble man, and he would talk often about how the God of Spinoza was my God, and that was fascinating to me, like, what kind of a God the greatest scientist of certainly the 20th century would believe in. And so there were those kinds of things early on, and then over the years I would gradually get into certain aspects of Spinoza, and, you know, there's a lot to him. I mean, there's a lot to him in straight philosophy. There's certainly a lot to do with him in terms of psychology, and he's probably one of the earliest sort of cognitive behavioral therapists, which, by the way, I find his cognitive therapy far more interesting and far more powerful than what my present cognitive behavioral therapy in my profession offers. But also, too, later on, I realized that he cared a lot about things like theology and political criticism. So the book that got him in the most trouble when he was still alive is something called The Theological Political Treatise. And this is, so all of those things became highly relevant to him, to using him as a, like I say, a lens to take a look at contemporary psychiatry.
So I'm talking with Bruce Levine. His new book out pretty recently is A Profession Without Reason, The Crisis of Contemporary Psychiatry, Untangled and Solved by Spinoza, Freethinking, and Radical Enlightenment. And we'll parse out some of those ideas as we go along. I'm Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. Be here till 9 o'clock this morning. And this whole idea of, you know, it was a very extreme in his case, as it has been with other radical thinkers, so-called heretics in history, especially by when the church was so dominant. This idea that of the, I really like the way you sort of turn the tables and focus on the reactions created by these figures, whether they're people, as you said, who are acting in seemingly bizarre ways, who are, disturbing the order of a school or other institution or a family. And so this the tension that's created by such figures, you turn the lens and look at the effect that they have on other people as being really the sort of actually in some ways more important than actually, what's going on in that person themselves. Is what gets them into trouble is how other people react to them. So this idea of you can think of figures like Galileo, go back to Socrates, Jesus Christ himself, and, certainly the witch-burning craze. There's obviously a massive tension created by these sort of residual figures of female figures who had a kind of knowledge, access to something that that other people, found fearful or maybe were in competition with or whatever. There's a lot going on, but get a little more deeper into that idea that you really, that kind of goes through your whole book.
Well, I think people have to really understand how these diagnoses, mental illness diagnoses, are created. They're arbitrarily created by a committee at the American Psychiatric Association, which is a guild of the American psychiatrists, and there's a select committee that votes on what's a mental illness and what is not a mental illness and what the symptoms are. And really the more interesting issue for me is like, well, on what criteria do they decide? Well, they may state one criteria, but really when you take a look at historically, the essential criteria is their belief on what behaviors out there make them uncomfortable and what they believe most of society will be made uncomfortable by. So the perfect, for me, one of the best examples of that is homosexuality, which was a mental illness, official mental illness, until 1973. And it was not taken out of psychiatry's diagnostic Bible, something called the DSM. It wasn't taken out because of science or put in. It was finally taken out because of gay activist protests. Why did they protest? Because for gay activists, even though progressives of the 1940s and 50s, I put those in quotes, I guess nowadays most people would put this in quotes, but it was progressive idea to view homosexuality rather than a sin or a crime, to view it as an illness. There was a belief among progressives that would create greater tolerance if you could just treat this condition. Well, of course, gay activists, knew that this was just as stigmatizing, maybe in many ways more stigmatizing, to be viewed as mentally ill as it was to be viewed as a disease, as it was to be viewed as a sin or a crime. And so they protested, and they won. This is one of the few times in the history of psychiatry where something has been abolished. Certain illnesses get the names changed from like manic depressive to bipolar, but it's very unusual for them to take something out, and it was only done because it was through this protest. Well, if you take a look at why it was put in and why it no longer is, it's like, well, in society back up until certainly 1940s, 50s, 60s, it created a lot of tension, homosexuality, given the politics and the country and the culture, and I guess it still does in some parts of the world, but not where you are in Portland, not where most of America, hopefully. It's it's not creating that much discomfort for folks to, and people who have friends who are homosexual. It's a completely different deal. So now, now it looks barbaric for psychiatry. But the interesting thing for me is take a look at some other things. In the DSM, when they finally was pulled out in the DSM-3, which was 1980, after it was abolished in 1973, that 1980 had a lot more children diagnosis, kid diagnosis. So that's where you see attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, and of course kids can't, organize and demonstrate at the American Psychiatric Association like gay activists could. But you take a look at the history of ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and you realize a lot of that has to do with how does that initially get diagnosed? Well, some teacher at school says to a
parent, like, well, your kid's not paying attention, you might want to take your kid for an evaluation at a pediatrician or a child psychiatrist. And that's how the process happens. And, you know, and that usually is enough, you know, for parents to go to an MD and say, well, the teacher said he's not paying attention. Boy, it's usually about a 10-minute thing before they're giving them a prescription for Ritalin or Vyvanse or one of these other amphetamine psychostimulant drugs. And what's going on there? Well, a kid is making a teacher in a classroom uncomfortable because they're not paying attention. Well, you know, 100 years ago, you know, when kids, it was not that big a deal for kids to, you know, just learn their ABCs and then, you know, split from school. In fact, a lot of families were happy if the smartest kid in the household wasn't a kind of school academic kid who wanted to go to college and stayed on the family farm. So the idea of a kid not really being comfortable in school and wanting to do other things was not that big a deal 100 years ago, but now it is. Now you've got parents terrified that their kids are going to have horrible lives, and that makes them horrible parents if their kids don't go not only get a high school diploma but get a college diploma, maybe graduate school, on and on. And so you have, again, the whole idea of, like, looking at what makes something a mental illness is, like, really, does it create discomfort and tension? And what makes something a serious, quote, I say that, quote, serious mental illness is if it creates severe amount of tension and discomfort. So, you know, and I can go on and on this, but I think you get what I'm saying here.
Well, and of course, you do draw attention to this, to the fact that we're such a efficiency and productivist oriented society, and a lot of times the behaviors that you're talking about, it can be in a school setting. Obviously, they're not being, you know, or productive in the way that that particular teacher might want them to be, or they're, you know, disturbing the productivity of the class, there can be legitimate concerns, you know, the if a whole class, you know, can be disrupted by one individual. But there's obviously, you know, the resources and time that schools have to actually deal with, you know, so-called problem kids is a whole issue that we could get into if we want. But then, you know, you talk about, you know, people who are experiencing some sort of crisis. You know, they're not able to maybe work. They're not able, you know, the whole emphasis on people needing to stay with, keep in the, you know, keep to the rhythm of the society and keep on plugging away, doing what they're supposed to do to, you know, to make the society function. That's very disturbing as well.
Right. I think that's the key thing, is that if you grasp the fact that how something is declared a mental illness or a serious mental illness has to do with how inconvenient that person is in an environment. And I totally understand if you're a teacher and you've got 25, 30 kids and one kid's not paying attention and acting disruptively, it ruins your day and maybe ruins the day of a lot of other kids in that classroom. So I totally understand that. But to leap from that to say, well, this kid has a disease, a brain genetic disease here that's causing that there's no science that goes with that, and the reason, one of the reasons why that we have this kind of medicalizing of those kinds of things is that it's just easier for society to do. It's easier to say, like, to say, well, this kid has this defect, let's put him on some drugs, which most of the time, you know, these kind of ADHD drugs, we have lots of research that shows it doesn't help people long term in terms of their academic performance. What it does is, like, for some kids, it just helps them chill out. They don't care as much. If you're on speed, you're on amphetamines, you don't care as much about your boredom. Just like if you're on nicotine, another stimulant, you don't care as much about your boredom, so you could behave better. And that's what it does. And so we rather do that in our society. It's much more inexpensive, besides, for our society to do that than to create alternate ways of education. And it also makes a ton of money for drug companies. So there's a lot of political pieces on the chessboard why we would rather deal with a kid who's, like, creating some disruption in the classroom the way we do in our society than other ways that we could possibly imagine doing that.
Yeah, I remember as a college student way back in the late 70s, early 80s, I did a semester as a student teacher at an alternative school. There still are some alternative schools. I think maybe by and large they tend to be, you know, come, you know, folded back into the more mainstream. But there's a few holdouts out there. But this one was one of those sort of classroom without walls, and was integrating like art into, you know, joint, you know, art and creativity into the what the kids were doing. It was a elementary school, and the spirit was really just wonderful. And you know, you didn't have like kids having to sit in, you know, straight rows or whatever. And I'm sure there are some places where they're still, but this was, you know, still coming out of the sort of the 60s revolt against, you know, conformity. And, you know, based upon some earlier thinkers that you actually mentioned in your book. But so, yeah, I mean, the idea that there are alternative ways to organize our education system and institutions really has largely disappeared from public discourse. So maybe you can respond to that. But also, in your Tractatus Psychiatrico Politicus chapter, you say, not that long ago would not have been all that radical to ask the following political questions about psychiatry and psychology, questions that Spinoza, if alive today, would likely consider. One, are psychiatrists and psychologists being used by authorities to compel individuals to adjust to a society that is unjust and dehumanizing? Two, are biological theories of mental illness diverting attention from societal ills that cause emotional suffering and behavioral disturbance? Three, are psychiatrists and psychologists being used to pathologize dissenters so as to marginalize them? Four, are mental health professionals undermining mutual aid and other forms of non-hierarchical organization and democracy? Let me just continue to kind of finish the point. Until his death in 1980, Eric Fromm was a high-profile psychoanalyst and social psychologist who wrote about the political implications of psychiatry. He occupied a prominent place in U.S. society, et cetera, et cetera. But then you say that now, by and large, this is that point of view, which, by the way, there's a book I talk a lot about called Madness is Civilization When the Diagnosis Was Social, 1948 to 1980, which basically outlines that whole way of thinking, and Eric Fromm is prominent in that book. It's largely sort of disappeared from public discourse, been marginalized.
Yes. I mean, that's one of the real pains for me, one of the real disappointments, that the profession that I went into, not that this was ever mainstream people, that you're talking about people like Eric Fromm and Foucault and all these kinds of folks who were, you know, thinking about the political implications about psychiatry, but it was taught, and a lot of folks knew about it. It was, you know, these guys would be on significant media in that era. And so one of the really frightening things for me today, and there's a lot of problems with what's happened to what the so-called left is really not longer any kind of left anymore. And this is not just in the spoke of the wheel of psychiatry. It's that a lot of folks out there are completely unaware of the fact that in that era that we're talking about, 1960s, it was obvious to folks, to the extent that you viewed people's problems in life, their emotional difficulties, their behavioral disturbances, as some kind of individual defect, some kind of brain disease, some kind of genetic defect, or is funny too. You were talking about Barbara Ehrenreich earlier, like at the end of Amy Goodman's was talking about her, is that she also was very much troubled by the idea of people blaming the victim in terms of like they weren't thinking positively enough, and that's why they got cancer. I mean, she wrote a lot about that in Brightside. It really upset her a lot, as opposed to like taking a look at the industrial carcinogenic conditions that were creating it. So you see this on a lot of levels, that it was once obvious that it was a right wing view to affix all of these individual defect reasons for why people are having emotional or even physical difficulties out there, and it was much more obviously a kind of left view to say, like, wait a minute, there are these societal conditions that are creating people's emotional, physical miseries out there. This was obvious, and that's disappeared. Sometimes when I talk about this with younger folks, they feel like, wow, that really feels radical. And I'm going, no, it's not. It shouldn't be. I guess now it is, but it shouldn't be.
Uh-huh. Again, this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your weekly host, Paul Rowland, and I'm speaking with anti-authoritarian psychologist Bruce Levine, whose most recent book is called A Profession Without Reason, which is, you know, in some ways we kind of just pursue some of the same themes that, you know, we've been thinking about our whole adult lives. And you've you've tackled this issue in many different ways. This is a particularly interesting one. I think Spinoza is a really fascinating figure, well worth looking, giving a fresh look at if people have even looked at him before. But I also want to invite you to call in. We've got only about 20 minutes left now in the show, and the number to call in and ask Bruce a question or make your own comment is 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. So while we're waiting for folks to weigh in, this whole issue of bias, tolerance, intolerance, bias, especially with the rise of sort of the Black Lives Matter, or I guess it's the new iteration of Black Lives Matter, since it's throughout history been come to the fore and then receded. But the whole issue of bias in policing has actually finally gotten some real attention. And actually, some police forces are actually really reckoning with that. And some police officers are actually forced to confront their own unconscious bias, how it affects the way, they stop one person and possibly not another. And so the whole issue of bias in your profession, clinical psychology, psychiatry, has a, you talk about that a lot in your book. Maybe you could talk about that. But has there been a sort of a similar, again, looking at bias in policing is all that widespread, or is become sort of a dominant trend, but has there been sort of an institutional, say at the American Psychiatry Association annual meetings or whatever, has there been an attempt to actually look at that?
Well, I don't go to the American Psychiatric Association, and for me, I would doubt that they would talk about it at the level that I'm going to talk about it right now, because it just contradicts a lot of what the essence of their whole institution is, which they really believe in things that schizophrenia is a disease no different than cancer, and it's a brain condition, and they have a certain kind of a narrative, a certain kind of dogma. And one of the things that is really interesting for me in terms of bias is like taking a look at why it is that most psychiatrists have a belief, for example, that if somebody has kind of flipped out, they've moved into a kind of psychotic state where they're acting bizarrely, they're talking incoherently, they have strange ideas, that they have this disease, and they needed to be treated with medication, often, treated with this for life, it can't be cured. So this is some of the jargon that you'll hear. And part of like why they've developed that bias, and I can understand that, like one of the early traineeships that I've had were in hospitals or in psychiatric emergency rooms, where you're seeing a very select skewed population of people who have flipped out. Maybe some of these people have gone off of their medication and they've returned and they're acting bizarrely, and so you develop a certain kind of view of an entire population on what you're not understanding is a very narrow population that you're seeing. And it was only for me, one of the ways that my bias was changed on this, or lifted, or gotten rid of, was by talking about other conditions out there that I got contacted by ex-psychiatric patients. Some of these folks were called psychiatric survivors, and they said, yeah, this is great that you're talking about ADHD and oppositional defiant disorder and all these other kind of conditions here, but let me explain to you like this whole thing, that there's a whole bunch of us out here that have flipped out, have been psychiatrically hospitalized, some of us against our will, and we don't have anything to do with psychiatry anymore. So they don't know anything about us. They don't see us in their hospitals. They we don't take their medication. We're not involved with them. We've gotten our acts together in other ways, and so psychiatrists will never see those kind of people. So they have a kind of skewed view that the reality is, if you take at research, and I quote a lot of research in that book by some of the most famous research by folks like Harrow and Job, who've done these longitudinal studies, that there have been people out there who, you know, when you take a look at longitudinally over, you know, a short period of time, maybe these antipsychotic drugs have helped people chill out, but when you take a look back at 5 years, 15 years, and they've gone up to 20 years, that the majority of folks who have good lives out there, who have stable jobs, who aren't going into mental hospitals, have stopped taking these medications. Now, people who are critical of psychiatry, none of us are anti-drug. We realize for some people, you know, given their life circumstances, they need something to help chill them out, whatever it is, you know, and so nobody's anti-drug, but we're just talking about the truths of the fact that there are plenty of people out there who've done much better, you know, having nothing to do with psychiatry.
Well, I actually wanted to respond to that because I actually had a, you know, a manic disorder is really a one-off thing. It was very sort of unusual at later in life to have your first manic episode. But yeah, they gave, I couldn't sleep. I had, you know, 4 days straight, no sleep. And I was thought I might be near my breaking point. I had enough sense to get help. And I just lucked out and got an interview with a psychiatrist and gave me a drug and it put me to sleep. And I was able to have the presence of mind to wean myself off of it over the months. And then, yeah. I thank my lucky stars for that particular drug. I think, you know, in other circumstances, if there was a real, sane social cultural system, there might have been places I could have gone where I could have chilled out without those drugs. And I think that's an important discussion that we've had on this show a number of times. Respite centers and used to be called freak out centers back in the heyday of the sort of the psychiatric survivors movement. But we have a listener who wants to put in their two cents or more. And that's Alice. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. I've had decades of experience with the state mental health system. And what I want to say is it has almost nothing to do with healing the people with mental illness on purpose. Mm-hmm. It's very frightening. It's very frightening because it's when they built the new state mental hospital, they didn't do anything to put it together so that the building itself would assist people in their healing.
Do you want to spell that out a little more? You mean, well, structurally the way they're set up?
Structurally, the way the state hospital was set up was not set up so that it would create a healing atmosphere.
Uh-huh.
It was set up as a prison.
Bruce, you want to...
So, well, there's a lot of things they could have done.
Uh-huh.
Simple things. One is that if you plant certain plants on the east side of a building and certain plants on the west side of the building, and they had plenty of room to do that at the state hospital site. When they, and then you have meeting times with the patients in the morning and in the evening when the sun is setting. And as the sun comes through those plants, it creates eye movement therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And that eye movement therapy helps the brain to reorganize.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't do that. They set it up as a prison. There were some patients that escaped from the old state hospital. So the purpose was to prevent escape and to prevent families or friends of patients who probably were completely out of control and did the wrong thing and were passing things through the fences so the patients could escape. And so they set the new hospital up to prevent any of that. So the hospital was set up as a prison, not as a healing spot.
Well, those are wonderful. Those are like just a couple of interesting examples I never would have thought of. I might have thought of, you know, just the decor, you know, the sort of less harsh lighting and, you know, stuff like that. And I'm sure that all those are, you know, I'm sure there's some places that have taken those things into account. Anyway, Bruce, do you want to respond to that?
Well, I've talked to hundreds, maybe thousands of people who've gone to, been in psychiatric hospitalizations, and I can't recall anybody ever telling me that it was a healing atmosphere or whatever. And healing is an interesting topic to talk about. Part of the problem of psychiatry, there's so many obvious gross problems of psychiatry, but one of the more interesting, like more subtle ones, is I don't even think they have an understanding of what really healing is, because part of like what healing has to do with is people become traumatized, they become disconnected, you know, from who they are, from other people, from life itself, and so a lot of healing has to do with how do you make people more whole with themselves, how do you make them more, you know, trusting of, you know, some connecting relationships, with, you know, feeling less terrified of life in general, and for me there's almost nothing that goes on in psychiatric hospitalizations where that happens. Now, this is not to say there aren't some kind of mental health professionals in any of these places who are dissident, rebellious, okay human beings who are doing some useful things for folks. Like in your case, somebody was smart enough to realize, wait a minute, a lot of the reasons why people go manic, they go psychotic, is one of the major reasons, and I've heard this from many people, is they, for a lot of reasons, they've just not been able to sleep for 3, 4, 5, 6 days in a row, and that's going to make anybody crazy. That's in fact, if you wanted to, and the military has done experiments like this on people, MK Ultra stuff, to try to get people to get crazy, you try to force them, not allow them to get any sleep. So a common sense thing is, let's use the safest kind of drug we could find to get people a day or two of, you know, get them some sleep. And so you're going to have mental health professionals who do those kinds of things with drugs, you know, smart, safe uses of it, or try to create some caring, understanding, respectful relationships. But that's more the anomaly than the practice that goes on. And what Alice is talking about, these places are sort of either low-level, minimum security prisons, or for some people they've been really horrific experiences, and for a lot of other people they've just been like totally non-productive. So that's, for me, the range is really non-productive, counterproductive. I can't recall anybody out there saying, and even talking to people who've gone to these super fancy, expensive places that rich people go to, that even most of those folks that I've ever talked to say like it has been not a completely non-healing place.
Yeah, it seems like just, you know, from what I've read and heard, is just the mere fact of sort of getting a time out, you know, they basically tolerated the bad or terrible aspects of the place, and they realized it within themselves that this was like a break, this was a chance for themselves to, on their own, basically to have enough healing so then they could get out and get on with their lives. But Alice, did you want to say another thing before we go to our next caller?
Well, I can wait, and maybe you can call me back. I've got some really other important things, but I'm not pulled together to talk.
Okay. Well, you can, if you have a, you know, if you have a computer or device, you could email me.
I'm illiterate.
Oh, okay.
I'm illiterate.
Well, I'm sorry. Well.
Technology.
Yeah. I mean, if you want, you could, you know, leave your information with our board operator. But thanks for calling in, Alice. We really appreciate hearing from you. And it looks
okay.
And have a good day. And I hope you're doing well. And it looks like we got one more caller. Jeremy, go ahead. You are on the air.
Hi, Paul. I actually, unlike most of your shows, I just tuned in. I was on the answering machine of Adult Protective Services, dealing with someone who's, you know, been hospitalized 10 times. He's my tenant and is soon to be not be my tenant because it's horrible having him or his wife as a tenant and his dog is waking up the neighbors.
And the reason you called?
No, that's not, you know, not that, that's why I called Adult Protective Services. And he's also being...
No, know, the reason you called us today...
The reason I called you is you're having a mental health show, so I don't know your guest name. Anyway, I will reflect upon my... I've also talked to, you know, in a year and a half of work, I talked to well over 2,000 clients. And actually, I'm a total abolitionist. I consider myself an ex-inmate of, you know, psychiatric police state. But I saw one or two people get helped, you know, there were more neutrals than I expected. And there were a whole lot of, you know, obviously people got destroyed. I think that the basic paradigm that that especially, you know, intensive mental health hospitalization is you have often young adults in family, you know, having trouble with life, drugs, whatever, and often, you know, mildly sociopathic behavior, they get brought in handcuffs to a psychiatric emergency room, and they get assigned a disease that probably doesn't exist, and treated with, you know, incredibly toxic drugs, which are mostly, you know, they're brain damaging, but they're sedating. You know, I personally, you know, have slept in five days I've slept 13 hours, four of them last night. That's a big improvement. So I'm right on the edge of sleep deprived. I refuse to use the word manic depressive or bipolar. I don't think you ever were. I think you were labeled it. I think you had a surfeit of energy, and to pathologize it. And it is pathological to sleep this little. You know, it makes me crazy and I act crazy, but I've learned how to cope with it.
Okay.
What happens when you get taught as an 18-year-old, you know, who's flipped out and then is slammed with, you know, in my case. So anyway.
Okay, we got to let you go. You can't use that kind of language. We only have a couple minutes left, and you just can't use that kind of language. You've done that before when you've called, and it just doesn't work. Sorry. So until you learn. And of course, those of you listening didn't hear the word that Jeremy used, but, you know, I'm sorry, it's a serious business. You know, we do have, you know, the FCC who follows us. And you want to react to what Jeremy said, and then we got just a couple minutes left.
Yeah, I think to try to make it as simple as possible, just to tell folks that you know, just imagine that everything in your life is disaster. You've lost your job. You've got relationship issues. You haven't been able to sleep, and you're just in a miserable state. What do you want? Do you want what psychiatry offers? These labels that are these unscientific diagnoses and these unscientific treatments, or would you rather have? And this is provided by some peer wonderful organizations. Not many out there, but they're kind of on underground. But would you rather have just somebody who's been where you've been, who's curious, and who's compassionate? And I don't think it's that difficult to call. And in some ways, it's as simple, really, as that. But of course, it's not that simple, because these, on the political chessboard, there's lots of gigantic, powerful pieces that will prevent having just those kind of supportive, curious, compassionate people around, and as opposed to what we have right now.
And of course, at the end of your book, you have a chapter, pals and peers, and I've had people from the, you know, the peer support movement, the peer support realm, on this program in years past quite a bit, and there's a fairly active community of those people in the Portland area, and If you want to get in touch with them through me, you can write to me through my program page at Wednesday Talk Radio, KBOO.FM. I'll be glad to hook you up if you'd like to do that. But yeah, the kind of people who give the best kind of support are people who've been through it and who've seen what doesn't work, and who know that the kind of direct, warm support is really the best kind of
right. Going back to the whole Spinoza and fear thing, that feeds right into it. If you've never been in a place of like severe depression where you felt suicidal, where you felt like life just isn't a good deal anymore, you're going to be terrifying for those kind of people are going to be terrifying for you. If you've never been in a place where you're just so you haven't slept so much that you're having crazy ideas and bizarre notions and you don't seem to be making sense, you're going to be terrifying. If you've been in that place, you're not going to be terrified. And what you want to be when you're in any of these kinds of states that are sort of maybe frightening for yourself and frightening for other people, you want to be around other people who are not frightening. You want to have that fear de-escalated, as opposed to, unfortunately, what goes on today, it's more inflamed. And because for me, again, it should be axiomatic that the less fear that we all have individually and the less fear we have of each other, we're going to just think more with more wisdom and more, you know, more rationally. It's just, you know, we may not be right all the time, but we got a better chance of being right if we're not having in this kind of fear-based thought, especially when that fear is incongruent, which it is for a lot of professionals.
Yeah, I really love at the end of your chapter, fear, which I found really crucial. All of them are good, but you have a list of 12 things. I guess the first ones are sort of this vicious circle that you're describing, the source where fear escalates within an individual, and then the reaction to that person, people are afraid of how that person is acting, talking. That fear feeds into it. And then the person gets more afraid. Anyway, it's a vicious cycle, as I said. I think this really, really, I've never seen it spelled out. So you really parse it out really well. Significant tension leads to the desire for simple answers that are easy to grasp and promise a quick tension reduction. But such answers may be superstitions or other such inadequate ideas, again, using Spinoza's phrase. But... saying that, we are out of time. So all I can do, Bruce, is refer to your book, A Profession Without Reason, The Crisis of Contemporary Psychiatry, Untangled and Solved by Spinoza, Freethinking, and Radical Enlightenment. If you missed a lot of it, you can rehear it at kbo.fm with that title, A Profession Without Reason. Thanks a lot, Bruce.
Thank you, Paul.
And that's it for Wednesday Talk Radio. Thanks to Ty for operating the board. Bye, everybody.
They say they made you live at home with mom and dad instead of mental hospitals. But every time you tried to read a book, you couldn't get to page 17. Cause you forgot where you were, so you couldn't even read. Don't you know they're gonna kill your sons? Don't you know they're gonna kill your sons? Your son, don't you know they're gonna kill?